You're listening to The Rant.
Please go away. Let me sleep for the love of God.
I am Kamala Harris. My pronouns are she and her. I am a woman sitting at the table wearing a blue suit.
You're listening.
So the best way to get something done, if you hold near and dear to you that you like to be able to. Anyway.
You fucking crazy, man. You sound insane. Do you realize that?
To the rant.
I speak jive.
Oh, good.
I've been saying it. I've been saying it for 10 damn years. Ain't I been saying it, Miguel? Huh? I've been saying it.
You're listening to The Rant with David King.
Everyone, welcome to The Rant. I am your host, David King. It is good to be here with you on this 17th of January. Happy New Year again. Walking Dead Part 4 special. It is exciting to be back and talking The Walking Dead. Oh boy, oh boy. I hope... A little problem with the soundboard there. I hope... Well, let's just strap ourselves in because we're moving very drastically and quickly close to where I left off. I think I finished off with The Walking Dead on season, I want to say it was season 6 or 7. Let me look. It might have been. No, it would have been probably season 7. Maybe it was season 8. Maybe I'm further away than I was. I'm looking at the notes right here. And I'm trying to figure it all out. Yeah, I don't remember. I'll have to figure it out. But there's one thing I will say. Moving into season 4, you start to see a difference in the way the show kind of moves about. One of the things that I spoke about in the last episode was the introduction of new characters, like Abraham and Eugene, and how they were just a little bit, they weren't horrible. Like, they're good characters, and I like Eugene and Abraham. I think they're great characters. Rosita's fine. Rosita's just like, you know, there's nothing to say about Rosita. She's just kind of an everyday, she's just a normal character. She's there to fit the space for what she needs to be. But Abraham and Eugene, they're kind of over the top, kind of extreme versions of people you think you'd run into in the real world. So like Eugene, he's kind of like this autistic, like super genius guy. And he's also a little bit of a hillbilly. So he's a little over the top. And then you have Abraham, who's the soldier, who's a little over the top with being a soldier, right? He just kind of blindly follows orders. He doesn't question, you know, he does what he's told. He has a mission. And when he has that mission, he executes it no matter what. Nobody deviates from the mission. We do the mission. We don't question it. We just go and we do it. And it's always been a frustrating thing for me because I'm like, first of all, I was in the Marine Corps and I never met anybody like that in the Marine Corps. And we're the most gung-ho, you know, hoity-toity branch of service, period. We think we're better than everyone, mainly because the Marine Corps is better than everyone. But besides that fact, I'm sorry, we weren't some brain-dead, mindless, robotic idiot that just charged oorah into battle without, you know, some sort of context. And his character is very much like that. It's almost like it was written by somebody who's never actually been around soldiers or Marines, but has an idea, like has their own pre-existing notion of how the military act. And you think to yourself, well, you know, these military guys, I see how they are on TV. They're very, you know, they're very stand up straight and salute and they follow orders and they do what they're told. So this must be how they are. It's like, it's not at all how we are. It's ridiculous. But I still like his character because he's funny. He's very likable. He says really goofy things. He's kind of a badass. He's kind of masculine in a way. So he's kind of one of the more masculine characters on the show. So he's kind of throwing his fists up, ready to punch someone's face in, which I quite enjoy. But anyway, we are starting to move into these shows or these episodes where this starts to kind of become commonplace, where you're seeing characters, who may be a little over the top. You're also starting to see a big change in the writing. And I'm on season five right now as I'm recording this. I'm about four or five episodes into season five. And I'm like, ah, yes, here we go. It is happening faster than I remember it happening, which is the idea of leaving you on some sort of cliffhanger at the end of an episode and the, excuse me, going into the next episode and it being something completely different from what the last episode was about. Like, so you get left on this cliffhanger. Maybe you see somebody fall, you think they're going to die, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And then the next episode starts and it's something completely different. It doesn't make, and you're like, what? This is not at all what I was wanting to watch. Like this, I was hoping to get some, to see more of what happened on the last episode, get some closure or something. But instead, you don't get that. You get a completely different story. And in some cases, which is what I saw in season five right now, I'm not trying to jump ahead, but in season five, I get a story that is uninteresting and not even necessary. Like, why are we seeing this right now? This is less interesting than what we have witnessed so far that season. So why are they giving it to me? It's frustrating, and I do remember it being a huge problem in that show. And I think and we're going to talk more about it because it's not horrible in season four. Season four, it's not so bad, but it starts in season four. It begins this whole all over the place sort of plot writing where you're one show, you're with these characters, and then the next show, you're with these other characters. And then there's this story over here is going on. So we're going to talk about that today. And you know what? I know. You want more, or you want some closure, or you want more information on this. This is what you're kind of locked in on. But guess what? Next week, we're going to give you something completely different. And it's going to frustrate the hell out of you. But we think that's good writing. It's not good writing. Not in my estimation, anyway. I just don't see that being good. But it kind of worked. And here's the thing. I think the reason why they kept doing it was because it worked pretty well for season four. You know, at first I was thinking to myself, like, I don't know if I really like this. And now, of course, I'm speaking towards the end of season four, after the prison war, when everyone's kind of scattered about. We kind of see that everyone, it kind of shows what everybody's going through. And since everyone's obviously not together, you're getting each episode is the story of this group, then that group, and then that group. And that's fine because it's all interesting. It all works together. Some of it's a little more interesting than others. But it kind of works out, and they add in some new characters, like some new villains, to those stories that kind of throw a monkey wrench into it and kind of make you go, oh no, what's going to happen? And so it worked out. And I think the reason why, because that worked out so well, they probably thought, oh, we can keep doing this. It works. Let's keep doing it. And it's like, no, you've overdone it. It's, it's quite all right to do that every once in a while, right? Especially if the story necessitates it, because in this situation, everyone is scattered from the prison and you have all these people wandering around trying to look for each other, trying to find sanctuary, trying to survive. And so how do you really write that into one show? Well, you could break up each person's story into one episode, and you could probably scatter that about three or four episodes where it's breaking away to each person at one time. And you could do that, but that also could be really, really difficult because now the pacing might go off, or it might be too much information in one episode, you know, where you say, well, we've got four groups of people wandering through the woods. How do we tell each person's story in one episode? Well, you may not be able to, it just might be too much. And so you may break it up. It also helps too for the writers because they can go, oh, this is low hanging fruit for us because now we have more episodes we can write. Cause they've got to write these episodes. You know what I mean? They've got to create content. Season four was, let's see, how many episodes was season four? It's quite a few. Sixteen episodes. So 16 episodes is a lot. especially considering that's about what it's like for every season. Now you might think, oh, 16 seasons isn't that much. But it's like, no. 16 seasons, they're about 30 minutes long. I know it's an hour long show, but you really have, it's like 35 to 40 minutes long. The rest of that's commercials. And I think it gets a little worse towards the end of the, when I stopped watching around season seven or eight, it seemed like the episodes were shorter. At least it felt that way. Like right now when I'm watching, of course, I'm not watching with commercials. I'm watching on Netflix. And you can watch along with me on Netflix if you have it. They have all the seasons there. And so I do remember it feeling like it was more commercials than actual show. But 16 shows is a lot, and you got to write that. You've got to make it interesting. And so when you can do it that way where it's like, well, I'll just write a whole episode dedicated to one character. And, you know, that's easy. I can do that because I've got 12 characters here, and most of them are pretty interesting, and everyone loves these characters. So let's just do a whole episode, and people will love it. The problem is you generally don't want to do that when you leave people on a cliffhanger, which they do quite a bit. They've done that quite a bit, and then with season five, it's even worse. So let's get into it. After I've already went on a long-winded rant already for 10 minutes. So season four picks up sometime later after the war with the governor, so right after season three. The governor attacks the prison. He's unsuccessful. He loses his mind. He mows down his entire army that he had of basically, they're not soldiers. They're just regular people trying to survive, and they didn't want to go back and fight, so he just kills them all. And his two henchmen, right, this one right-hand man and this other guy, I guess at some point they abandoned him. But anyway, this is right after the war. And then so from the opening of this scene, we see there are many people now living under the roof of the prison. They have kind of a big community. There's a farm now with crops and livestock, and everyone seems to be thriving. It seems to be going pretty well. They've got like a little school going on for the kids with a library. It's pretty interesting. And of course, you know, that makes sense because the title of the episode is 30 Days Without Incident. And that's clearly the case here. It seems like everyone's been doing pretty well and getting along just fine. And in fact, the answer to our question after season two, which I think is very interesting, I asked, will Rick become the malevolent tyrant? And I kind of briefly touched over this in the last episode of the rant, not to go too far back into it, but, you know, Rick was kind of like, it's my way or the highway after season two, after the farm fell. And he was like, he took the reins of leadership and was going with it, and he was doing it. And it's my way or no way kind of fashion. So it said, well, you know, what pathway is Rick headed down? Is he going to become like Shane? Well, Shane wasn't the tyrant. Shane just lost his cool. He couldn't control himself. But the governor was the tyrant, right? He was the malevolent tyrant. He was the one, very similar to Rick. Rick could have very easily ended up like the governor, right? You make a mistake, it costs someone you care about's life. And so, you know, where do you go? And in some cases, he could have very easily went down that path after he lost his wife, Lori, but he didn't. So what we see here is, he finds his inner monster. He has his will to lead and to survive. But the answer to the question, will he become the malevolent tyrant? The answer is no, a resounding no, he did not. And in fact, it could be showed that he's not only a leader from the last season, but a great leader after this episode. In fact, one of maybe the greatest leaders that we could see as an example. He's the greatest example of leadership that we can look at in a story. Why is that? And the reason I say that is because Rick willfully relinquishes his authority as a leader, and he has the group form a council to make decisions. You know, the true sign of any good leader, and this is in politics, this is at the workplace, anywhere you go in life, a very good sign of a leader is one who is willing to step aside and let someone else take over. They do not cling to power. They don't seek to gain more of it. They don't try to hang on to it. They're okay with relinquishing it. This is also indicative that the group has been without real problems too for some time. They've established a sort of democracy within the prison. But, you know, of course, that democracy will be tested very soon. And I like this. I like this look. I think it makes sense. Rick's tired. He's done his duty. He's done his job. He's led this group. They've established the prison. And in his mind, it's like, look, I want to be a farmer. I've done what I'm supposed to do. I've gotten you all here. We're safe. Everything's great. We have a council now. They'll make the decisions. That way it's not just one person making decisions. It's not ruled by a single man, but rather a group. And so it just goes to show you the content of Rick's character. That even after all of the things that he's been through and all that he has lost, and all that he has sacrificed along with the group too. It's not just Rick, everyone sacrificed, but just the fact that he was the leader. Everything that he has sacrificed, he's still willing to relinquish this power. That's the trust he has in his group and the ability for them to move everyone in the right direction. The first several episodes of the season of season four deal with a very unexpected virus. This is that's going around in the prison and causing people to die. This is it's full blown panic mode too, and it's interesting to see this, that once this virus really starts to take over, and it's, you know, after it unfortunately kills a little kid, and then next thing you know, it's taking everybody else out. It immediately pulls Rick out of retirement from being a leader. So it's interesting to see that once crisis hits the prison. The group, including Herschel mainly, because even though they have this sort of council, it appears that Herschel is kind of like the Speaker of the House of that council, right? He's kind of like the head of it, even though he's not. He is one of the elders, obviously. He is, by and large, he is Rick's compass, okay? The way you need to look at Herschel's character in this story of things is Herschel is very much Rick's moral compass. He helps keep Rick in line because Rick is a pretty reasonable guy, even no matter what. And so having someone who's level-headed, who's seen some things, who's been through a lot, who has experiences, that's Herschel. And he helps Rick quite a bit. But Herschel also is not the kind of person who wants to lead. Herschel equally leans on Rick for leadership. It's interesting how that kind of all works, right? Herschel wants Rick to make decisions. And so what happens here when the virus kicks off, Herschel is well equipped to take over this situation and lead it. He's a doctor. He's a veterinarian, but he's still a doctor and he has medical training. So he knows how to kind of navigate this. They also have another doctor in the prison who's unfortunately sick with the virus. But he helps as well, but Herschel leans on Rick to make decisions on how to save the people from this infection. And so Rick has to step up again and be a leader. So it kind of goes to show you that in crisis mode, how quickly things revert back to a single point leadership and how quickly they revert back to Rick. It's just another testament to how good of a leader he is. People trust him. They trust his judgment. He's built that for himself. And I really like these first few episodes because it kind of touches on something that most shows really don't go there. Like they don't really talk about it, or they wouldn't make an episode about it. And it's because most people don't think about this sort of thing happening, which is like a virus outbreak or something within the prison. Like people don't think about, you know, if you're watching a zombie apocalypse, everyone's worried about turning it into a zombie. Nobody's worried about catching the flu and dying from the flu. But that is a real issue, especially now. I mean, the reality is now that there's no modern medicine, right? That's gone. You do have medicine on the shelves, but eventually that'll run out or it's going to be hard to find. There's no water treatment plants. There's no soap. There's no sanitary functions that we're used to. You know, there's no air purification. There's no HVAC. You know what I mean? Like all these things that we take for granted, all these amenities that we have today, especially in this country, in the Western world, that we take so for granted because it's been there forever. But running water, for instance, we just turn on the tap, drink some water. We're good. You can't do that. And contrary to what you may see on a TV show or what you may have heard, you cannot go down to the local stream and just drink from it. You will get sick. You could likely get so sick that it would kill you. You have to boil your water. You have to filter your water in some cases, depending on how close you are to a city. That water might be very polluted. And so all these things are gone now. And, you know, people would be getting rather sick and often in the later months and years in an apocalypse setting because our immune systems are just not what they used to be. Our immune systems are very strong, but they're very strong for our society. If you were to take a person right now and pick them up and drop them in the middle of the Horn of Africa, it's very likely that they would get sick pretty quickly. And they could get sick with some pretty serious diseases. There's a reason why when Marines go to deploy, and they do this with all branches of the government, not just the Marine Corps, but because I'm a Marine, I'm going to talk about the Marine Corps. When you go to deploy, they inject you with all kinds of vaccinations and antibody things and you name it for a myriad of diseases because you could catch them in these countries you're going to. And so they don't want you to get sick. Ironically enough, though, you will feel like dog shit quite a lot right after you get them. I've heard the horror stories. Thankfully, I didn't deploy, so I didn't have to worry about that. But some of my friends who did talked about how they were sick for like 4 or 5 days, like feeling really awful after getting those shots. So anywho, yeah, so that's the case. You know, you pick somebody up, put them in Africa, put them in another third world country, put them anywhere where there's not modern medicine and running water, and you'll find out real quick how susceptible we are to getting sick and getting disease. And if you add all this too, in their situation, you add all this to being cramped in a dark, you know, concrete prison with little to no ventilation, and people will start to spread their germs rather quickly. I mean, that's the one thing about the prison I will say is kind of a drawback, and something they never really touched on, but it would have been interesting to hear, like, or see something about it would be, how hot does a prison get in the summer? How cold does it get? You know, this is a facility that's, you know, basically masonry. It looks like a big concrete building, right? Metal bars, concrete floors, concrete walls. It's very kind of damp looking and cold. There's no circulation, no air circulation. I can imagine the mold and everything would start to kind of, build up in that facility, which that alone will make you sick. But it's the real first time that we kind of see that the group realizes that they need medicine for things beyond just cuts and bruises. This is the first kind of, oh no, we actually need some sort of level of medical care and medical supplies on hand, because people are getting things that we've never experienced and we don't have anything to deal with it. So Herschel starts a quarantine area and starts treating the sick. It becomes very dangerous as people start to die in their cells and then change to walkers. So it's a very dangerous and complicated situation. Again, I love the tension of the quarantine zone with Herschel being in there. He doesn't have his leg, so he's kind of hobbling around on stilts, or crutches rather, stilts. I mean, come on now, crutches. And everybody else is sick, laying in their bed, trying just to not die. And then all of a sudden a walker comes barreling in after you. So it's the tension and the excitement there on those shows, and those episodes were very good. I love that. The group sets off. Though they send the group off to find meds at a local college, and Herschel and Rick do all they can to stop the containment. Eventually, though, they do find the meds. They get the meds. Get there in time to save the important characters. That's the thing you need to remember. No major character that we know of dies. You see some kind of, I would say, I call them B characters, if that. So when I talk about characters, and I'm going to start talking about this a lot more, down the road with The Walking Dead, and I may even mention it in other series that we do, but there's A characters, B characters, C characters, and maybe D characters, but very rarely. And so an A character is your main character. So that's like Rick, Glenn, Maggie, Daryl, the people that have been basically on every episode and have the story focus around them pretty heavily. They have a lot of lines, you know. These are your main characters. Your B characters are generally characters who are not necessarily main characters, but they're around enough, they're important enough where they kind of facilitate and supplement the main characters. They're all kind of, they kind of orbit around the main characters, if you will, and they add to the story. Your C characters, generally, I kind of combine C and D characters somewhat together. Someone who writes scripts might kind of argue with me, but your C characters are the lesser characters. They're people that usually show up for one episode, maybe two episodes. C characters may have more than one episode. They may have a little bit more importance than just hanging out in the background, but they're not generally going to be around for a while. And then you have your D characters, which are usually maybe not even a full episode. It's like a scene. Might be a guy that comes barreling out of a room saying, "Help me, help me," and then gets mowed down by a zombie. That's a D character. They're just people who are kind of thrown in as sacrifices. They're there to kind of help the story move along or to shape out a scene, but they're not very important. They're not going to be around for very long. I would say in the first four episodes, at best, you have the only people that we lose are B characters. Now, A characters get sick because Glenn gets sick. The woman, Rachel, or what's her name? Oh, what is her name? I cannot remember. It's Tyrese's sister, and I just can't remember her dang name to save my life. Well, shoot. Anyway, I'll figure it out. Sorry, guys. She gets sick, but neither of them die, and that's fine. I don't really care, but mostly anybody that dies were just either people we've never even seen before or a B-list character like Tyrese's girlfriend is kind of a B list character because she was only really around. She was around in the last season, but she had very minor appearances. And then she was around in this one a little bit more. Right. So she kind of moved from a C to a B. But anywho, they get the meds in time to save the important characters. And after a close call with a large zombie outbreak in the quarantine, all is getting better. Except that Carol, we found out, killed a few of the people, including Tyrese's girlfriend, and burned their bodies in hopes to stop the spread of the infection. That didn't work out. And all it did was really send Tyrese into a rage and get Carol exiled from the prison. That's a summary of it all. I'm not going to get into it really deep. It's just what it is. I think it's a great way of outlining where Carol's gone as a character, her big arc as Carol's big character arc is her going from kind of the timid housewife who's, you know, obviously domestic abuse and all that's really, really awful, but it's made her very timid and kind of shy and kind of like, you know, kind of coward. She's turned from that kind of cowering woman who sits in the camper and cries as people look for her daughter. She's gone from that to the woman who goes out and looks for her daughter herself, by herself, and can handle her own business, right? So her big arc has been, I take care of business. And I think it's a good arc because Carol's a great character. And I also think that was very well written because it's in line with who she is. She's not a malevolent person. She's always had a big heart, very agreeable, but the new world has made her less agreeable. She's a little more disagreeable now temperamentally, and now she's more balanced. However, in this episode, we're starting to see her lose a little bit of that balance, right? Because she's a woman who could take care of business. Yep, good, awesome. But you need to know boundaries. You need to know that you can't do certain things, right? And taking it upon yourself to, you know, execute and burn some bodies that were sick, you know, that's a bridge too far, I think. But again, it goes in line with her arc because she too is someone that lost something. For she may blame herself, but it's really not her fault that her daughter got, you know, chased by those zombies and ran off. They were all kind of hiding and they did the best they could. But she lost something. And a lot of times the story that we see with these people and so often is they've lost something because of a decision they made or lack thereof, and they're mad at themselves and resentful. That's the story of the governor. He didn't step up and do what he needed to do, and he lost his family. That made him hateful and resentful, and it turned him into a tyrant. Carol lost her daughter, and now here she is. But yeah, I like this scene. I like this Carol. I like seeing where her character's going. I did think the fact that she was exiled by Rick was a bit strange. I would have liked to maybe had seen that play out a little bit differently. Maybe she comes back. Maybe the council, actually we could see the council at work because maybe they could decide on her fate. Like instead of just Rick making the decision to be like, you need to go because Tyrese is going to basically kill you. It would have been nice to see some level of like democracy, like justice happen. Or maybe she still gets exiled, right? But it's more of a diplomatic process. And maybe that's just nitpicking, I guess. And maybe that wouldn't have been interesting. Maybe it would have sucked, but I would like to maybe see that written out and how that could have played out. But it is what it is. So she gets kind of cut out, but she lingers near the prison because later on she kind of rears her head again. And so all that's done. She gets exiled. The prison is looking pretty good. Everyone's getting healthier. Then suddenly, as things are getting interesting in the prison and worked out, we suddenly see a cut to a man standing in the woods watching the prison. Oh, it's ominous. With ominous music. And who is such a man but none other than the governor himself? The devil has come back for his fill, ladies and gentlemen. Just when you thought he was gone, and every one of us kind of knew he wasn't. I don't remember how I originally felt when this season kicked off so long ago, because I think we all were wondering, what is the story with the governor? Because at the end of the third season, he's just kind of wandering around with those two dudes, and it's like, well, does Rick go after him? Like, what happens? And so one of the things we get kind of told in the beginning of the season is they can't find him. They don't know where he is. They think he's dead, right? Michonne's been going out every day looking for him and can't find him. And so I think she eventually gives up on it. So then after that, we're plagued with a very slow and drawn out episode of the governor wandering around, barely surviving, looking like a homeless guy that I saw in Atlanta one time. And this is where that whole like cut to a scene, cut to a different story altogether, right? We were in the story of the prison with the little pandemic going on in the prison. Now we have cut from that to the governor. This works here because they are setting you up for what's to come with the governor and Rick. And because they gave you that little teaser of the governor standing outside the prison, it's nice to know his backstory, like what happened after he mowed down his people, what went on. He ends up finding a family who's living in an apartment, and he befriends them. You know, it's like, and he meets this family. It's two women, a little girl, and the woman's father who's very sick. And it's like, oh, if only these ladies could see past the charm of this bearded hobo. Like, you know, it's like, dude, you have no idea. They have no idea the level of the devil that they have let in. They have no idea what devil they let into their house. But unfortunately, in this new world, everyone is so desperate for tomorrow, they'll just about let anybody in. And these ladies do that. Eventually, though, they all set off and end up running into a group that's led by one of the governor's right-hand men from Woodbury. What are the odds of that? You know, and in this big old world, what are the odds that he runs into them? Anywho, but they do. And it doesn't take very long for the governor to kill this guy in order to take over as the group's leader. So immediately, you know, the show's kind of setting you up to think like maybe the governor has a change of heart. Like maybe he's becoming a good guy, right? He finds his family. He's taking care of them. He stepped up to help them. Look at him. He's kind of being almost like the male role model, father figure for the little girl, and also like the father husband role for the woman. You know, he's stepping up to protect them and lead them. And so you're kind of getting this idea of like, did the governor change? Did he realize the error of his ways? But then once he meets this group and meets this guy, he starts scheming, and before you know it, he kills the dude and takes over as the group's leader. And I want you to notice something. Notice the difference in leadership between Rick and the governor. Like, do you see what I'm talking? Like, have you seen the difference? Maybe it's a little more obvious and you're just saying, yeah, Dave, come on. But there's a huge difference. In the first episode, we see Rick has given up his power and he refuses to take it back when asked to, right? Because Herschel's like, we need you to come back. We need your leadership. We need your I suppose, ability, right? We're looking for you for answers. And he refuses. He doesn't want it. He's like, no. You have the council now. You don't need me. It's okay. Meanwhile, the governor, well, he kills the man in charge and threatens his soldiers to obey or else. So there's, and thus, you know, Hitler has come back for a second time. That's what you have. And that is the huge difference between a radical leader who is a evil person versus Rick, who is the good leader who is willing to give it up. And so the governor also wastes absolutely no time in telling all these people that have been surviving here and, you know, maybe not in a perfect scenario, but they seem to be surviving and doing okay. But he convinces them that they have to go and wage war on the prison and take it for themselves. And naturally, everyone is against this idea for obvious reasons. None of these folks, except for one guy, is a soldier, and none of them want to die in battle. And frankly, anyone with half a brain could really pick apart the governor's argument on why they need to go after this prison. You know, he says it's a safe place. It's a sanctuary. You know, this is where I know we can thrive. But the reality is this wasn't about keeping anyone safe. This was a revenge tour, plain and simple. And a plan to create as much chaos as he could in the shortest amount of time. Like we spoke about in the previous episode of The Rant. You know, if I can't have it, no one will. He's Hitler. That's who he is. He's like, I'm going to create the most amount of chaos and destruction as fast and rapidly as possible. And whatever happens, happens. If he wanted to keep everyone safe, he could have easily taken them back to Woodbury. Because if he's scoping out the prison and creeping on Rick and Carl out in the farm, he could very easily have scoped out Woodbury and seen that it's empty and started over. And he could have lied. He could have said, my name's Pete. And, you know, this is where I stayed. And then it got overrun. And There's nobody here now, but you know what? It still has the infrastructure. We can kind of put it back together and start over fresh. But he didn't do that. Or for that matter, any other number of places besides the prison. He could have taken them anywhere to protect them. The show makes you believe that he wants to protect this woman and this little girl, but that's not the case. Maybe he does, but it doesn't appear that way, right? If we want to know the real motive of someone, we have to see what they're doing, right? We need to look at them and go, okay, I really don't know what this guy's up to, but let me look at his actions. Well, his actions are, I'm waging war on everyone when I don't have to. I'm destroying everything. I come barreling in with a freaking tank, right? Everyone, all these people that I'm charged to protect are being mowed down now. They didn't have to die. So it's him wanting to create as much chaos as fast and as possible as he can. This guy's just pure evil, that plain and simple. And he's got a chip the size of the planet on his shoulder. And so that is what happens. But not before capturing Herschel and Michonne. The governor planned to use them as pawns to get Rick to leave the prison, but I believe he knew that Rick and the group wouldn't leave and intended to start the war over by getting back at Michonne. So he's got the Michonne. So he's already halfway through there. He's really happy about that. And he happens to pick up Herschel, which it appears he may have a little respect for, but not really. So the governor arrives at the prison with a small army. Oh, and a tank, by the way, because, you know, why not? Freaking tank. Again, we've moved into the level of a bit of absurdity. I mean, at this point, I could understand if you had a tank in the first season, the second season. It's almost believable because we saw tanks in the streets of Atlanta. It is very likely that those tanks still operate. They got fuel in them. They're good to go. They've been serviced. The only reason why they're not working right now is because there's nobody behind the wheel. But at this point, this far into the apocalypse, it's like, where are you finding the fuel for this tank? Because I believe, well, that's an older tank too, by the way, which is, it's not a very current tank. We don't use that tank anymore, but whatever. I'm just saying, like, the show could have at least gotten something a little more up to date, but they didn't. That's fine. They got probably what they could. I believe those old tanks were definitely diesel, but I know newer tanks, if I'm not mistaken, run on JP-8, which is jet fuel, because I believe they have like a jet engine. Like, I think the Abrams actually has a jet engine in it, if I'm not mistaken. Like, that's what powers the M1 Abrams tank, which is the tank we use, which is getting replaced, by the way. I just read that the other day, just a small caveat. But anyway, they got a tank. Why not? It's, you know, we're already here, so let's just do it. And so negotiations are attempted between Rick and the governor. So Rick is trying to appease to the governor. So he's trying to appease to the devil. And as you all know, you cannot appease to the devil. It's impossible. Needless to say, the governor is losing his likability with the people in his charge as well. So because Rick is literally telling them to their face, and he's actually, at one point, he's no longer pleading to the governor. He finds the woman who later rescues, kind of helps Glenn. He sees her and he appeals to her. He's like, this dude's irrational. He's not listening to me. I can see on your face, you have a level of doubt of why you're here right now and what you're about to do. So let me appeal to you. And he does, right? He's like, look, there's enough room for all of us. We don't have to fight. You can come in here and you can live. Like, we can coexist. He even says, Rick says, you can come back from all of this, right? Meaning we can move forward. We can forgive and move forward. No one has to die. And the governor, he wants nothing to do with it. And that's because he just wants to kill Rick and destroy everything he built. This is about revenge and nothing more. So when Rick says that we get to come back from this and we can move on, well, that triggers the governor and he kills Herschel. He mumbles under his breath, liar. And he kills Herschel, which is, I hate that scene. I did not want Herschel to die. Herschel was such a great character. When Herschel dies, like I said before, Herschel was Rick's moral compass. He's kind of what brought, he's the guy that always brought, he's the guy that brings Rick back from losing his mind. He's the guy that kind of keeps Rick on a level playing field before Rick steps off the deep end and it becomes maybe a little too much. He's always been that guy. And immediately once he gets killed, Rick loses that. And so he gets killed. The gunfire breaks open and the battle begins. That's a pretty interesting battle. You know, the two groups fight it out pretty hard, but, you know, the tank comes barreling through. And that's another thing. Like, when you watch this fight, like, this tank comes busting through the fence, right? The whole appeal to this prison is it is surrounded by a giant fence. And not just one fence, but two fences, right? It was designed to keep people in. It just so happens it works great for keeping walkers out. Well, you just plowed through it with your freaking tank. And you're also, by the way, blowing up the prison. He's shooting at the prison. Like, he just constantly keeps reloading and firing at the prison, blowing holes in it. So now you're destroying the very community that you were trying to supposedly take over. If in fact, the governor wanted this prison for his community, he would have been like, yo, bro, lay off the damn gun. Stop blowing up our prison. You're destroying everything. We're not going to have anything left. And by the way, who's going to fix the damn fence now? And oh, by the way, there's a horde of walkers behind us because we've made all this noise. Again, this is about chaos. This is not about survival. This is not about anything other than getting back at Rick and creating as much pandemonium as you possibly can. But eventually, most of Rick's group escapes on a bus. So a lot of people get out, and others get out in other ways. Everyone just kind of scatters and falls back and gets out. The governor's group pretty much gets completely wiped out. And from the looks of it, at that time, there are no survivors from the governor's group. Meanwhile, the governor and Rick are fighting it out in the field there. Just, and Rick's holding his own for a good minute, but then the governor gets the better of him. But Michonne ends up sending her katana blade right through his chest. And but it ends up being the governor's little girlfriend that ends up finishing him off. It's a fitting scene where the woman who accidentally let the devil in sends him back to hell where he belongs. Unfortunately, we find out later she didn't make it out of the prison alive and became walker bait. So this guy, this is what happens when, you know, this is a metaphorical thing for life, right? When you, if you don't vet the people that you let into your life, it's very likely they could lead you to death, right? Or they could lead you to hell. And that's exactly what the governor did. They see this man walking down the street by himself and they let him in. They should have never have let him in, or at least they should have vetted him more, which I don't think they really did very well. And you could say, well, Dave, how are they to know? It's like, well, you may have known, you know, you could have asked some questions or you could have questioned it, like, I don't know about this. And so they let the devil in and the devil took him to hell. And the only one left is now that young woman who saves Glenn. And again, I wish I could remember her name. Tara. There it is. Lily is his girlfriend, I think. No, Megan. No, Megan's the girl. Lily, Tara, and Megan. That was the three women that befriended the governor. And so Tara's the only one left standing. And she sees the error of her ways, and she kind of, you know, she gets to come back from it. But that's the thing, like, you know, she didn't get to come back from it without any kind of sacrifice. She had to help Glenn. She had to earn her right to be in that group. And she's very lucky because she could have very easily been dead just like the rest of them. So yeah, it was a good scene. I like it. She shoots him, kills him. He watches it as she puts the gun in his face resentfully and pulls the trigger. You could tell she was, he knew it and she knew it. She's like, you're basically a piece of shit. You know, look what you did to me, and puts him out of his misery. I wouldn't have done that personally. I would have let him rot. I would have let him turn to a zombie. Now, all is pretty well and good up to this. All is pretty well and good up to this point in the season. I've enjoyed this season quite a bit so far up to this point. You know, we had a lot going on. We had a lot going on in just very short amount of time there. You know, we had the outbreak in the prison, the reuniting of the governor and his story, and then the battle for the prison. That's a lot in like basically the first half of the season. And then of course the prison is wiped out and everyone in the group, everything in the group, is gone. Like everyone that was together is now, they're spread out throughout the entire area, you know. And that's where the show starts to go off the rails just a little bit. You know, I look back at it now, maybe I'm a little harsh, but, you know, I love multiple plots, stories, situations under one roof. I think it makes for a really complex show filled with lots of information and details, and you got to pay attention. It's good. It's rich. It's deep. Whatever. Fulfilling. satiating, whatever you want to use. But this might have been a little too much, but I also digress in the, and I will say, I'll give the devil his due, where I will say that you may have had no choice but to write it out this way to make it make sense. Because from here on out, each episode is basically following each member or members of the group that's scattered out and tells their story of basically how they eventually reconnect or make it to a place called Terminus. So the whole point of this last half of the season is to tell how all these people managed to make it back to the same point. And that's hard to do, right? You can't really, you probably couldn't have done that. You probably couldn't have told everyone's story in one episode, or I'm not saying you had to do it all in one episode. I'm just saying like you couldn't have mixed in everyone's stories as the show progressed. You probably had to dedicate episodes to each person. But then you have to ask yourself, is the story interesting enough where it needs its own episode? And the answer to that is, I don't think so. I mean, maybe, but you have to really think about it. Like when you look at Carol's story with Tyrese, with the two girls, like that's a compelling story. But at the same time, I don't know if it needed a whole damn episode. I don't know if I needed a whole episode to realize that that little girl was a psycho and, you know, was probably going to do something crazy, right? That whole episode was like, I don't know. It does outline, there's a level of forgiveness between Tyrese and Carol. There's a level there where Carol realizes the error of her ways and what she did was wrong, and she's kind of leveled out a little bit, but she's still very much feels like an outsider for some reason now, and that kind of carries out into the next season where she doesn't really want to be a part of the group. And I don't know if it's because she's afraid to lose someone, and I'm sure they're going to touch on it more. I know they do, but I just can't remember what it was. But she's really antsy to get away from everyone and just kind of be a loner. And I just think it's just the level, it's just the amount of pressure weighing on her being in this world, right? You're trying to survive. It's constant. There's no time to rest. There's no vacations in the apocalypse. It's just like, if you get to sleep, right, you wake up and you're right back in the nightmare. And so it takes a toll on people. And it makes it worse too when you lose someone. So, but I don't know if that needed a whole episode. Then you have the episode of Beth and Daryl. And again, I don't really know if that needed to be an entire episode of them kind of surviving and wandering around and hanging out. You kind of see two very polar opposites, you know. Beth is innocent and Daryl's just kind of burly man. But anyway, you know, but I digress. It's how they did it. I don't know if I love it or I hate it, but they may have had no other choice. But here we are. That's what they did. And so from here on out, each episode is basically following each member, like I said, and it tells us how they all eventually meet at one point, which is going to be Terminus, which is ironic because they're all going to meet at the final location, which is called Terminus. Anyway, it's not lost on me. Rick's basically half dead at this point. So it starts off with Rick and Carl, and he's half dead. Like he's literally going into a coma. And Carl apparently hates him for losing the prison and probably Herschel's death and whatever. Carl has like, for whatever reason, Carl's mad at Rick for a very short amount of time. Because by the next day he loves his dad again, because well, it is his dad after all. Right. And so I don't know why he was like, it was like he was bitter as if Rick couldn't do what he needed to do. It's like, why is Carl mad at Rick? Like Rick is literally laying there half dead because he just beat the shit out of the governor and fought the governor off. And then, you know, I don't know. I guess maybe because he feels like his dad didn't have the cojones to just shoot the governor right there. Fair enough. Carl's a kid. He doesn't know any better, right? He's like, yo, kid, you don't just pop a guy when you got a bunch of guns pointed at you. It doesn't work that way. And so, and then of course, Michonne eventually finds Rick and Carl and everyone's happy. Ha, ha, ha. Daryl and Beth, Maggie's sister, who really up to this point was never really important and did not really lend much to the story other than, you know, singing when the mood needed to be set for a scene. But the writers were smart enough to pair her with Daryl. This is where I said, did this need to be a whole episode? I don't know. But at least they were smart enough to pair Beth with someone we actually care about and we're invested in, which is Daryl, who's interesting and made more so. And he is made more so interesting when he's lost with someone as innocent and naive like Beth is. You know, Beth to this point is still kind of this innocent little girl. Like, she's not really, I mean, she's supposed to be like an adult. I think she's like 18, I think, or 17. But so she's still kind of naive. She's just adolescent, you know, and for the most part, she stays back in the prison the entire time. And Herschel's farm, she stayed back in the farm the entire time, in the house, rather. She didn't ever really got out. So she's not really this kind of well-trained soldier like everybody else is. Well, anyway, somehow she gets kidnapped, but who we don't know. And then Daryl's picked up by a gang of marauders, pretty rough dudes, but nothing Daryl, no one that, you know, Daryl can't handle or hang around. Because after all, Daryl at one point was a pretty rough dude himself. He still is a rough dude, but he's his character arc is he kind of goes from being this, you know, criminal, right? Kind of a bad guy, just kind of out for himself, very selfish, to this very, he goes from being selfish and only caring about himself. He was going to steal and take whatever he needed to take. And so he goes from being that guy to now being someone that everyone can rely on. He's a soldier. He's a tracker. He's kind of Rick's right-hand man, right? He takes the place of Shane being Rick's kind of reliable friend. He's very level-headed. And so he gets picked up by the gang of marauders, pretty rough dudes. And then we go over, we have Glenn, who's found still at the prison, surrounded by the dead. He finds Tara, one of the girls that the governor befriended, and then she's the only survivor from that group. They set off to find Maggie, and in the process of it all, run into three new characters. And boy, are they some caricatures. Again, I start to realize that this is where the show begins to change big time. You know, after the war in the prison, it was clear that the writing changed hands for the show. It's so obvious. It's almost as if, like, you hired the same guy to write, right? Boop, 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 boom. And then out of nowhere, you just say, hey, you, get out. We're going to put this guy in. It is so clear as day that somebody else has been writing for this show since the first couple of seasons. And come to find out, that was true. Like, I could see it by the way the show played out and how everything went down. But you could, man, what happened? Like, this is like a completely different show I'm watching. And now I know why. The original writer for the first two seasons was fired. For the life of me, I can't understand why. And from what I heard of the original cast, based on a podcast I listened to, you can hear that podcast. It's actually John Barenthal's. I'm sure I just screwed up his last name. The guy that played Shane, he has a podcast called The Real Ones. And he had the woman that played Rick's wife, the woman who played Lori. What's her name? Sarah Wayne Callies. He had her on his podcast and she talked about it. So for like instance, Lori was never supposed to die. It wasn't in the comic, and that was a change. And it might be because Sarah Wayne Callies, the actress who played Lori, was the one who kind of pushed back the most on that decision for that guy to get fired. She kind of stood up and needless to Needless to say, she died on that hill. And no pun intended, but literally, really, her character was killed off. Now, don't get me wrong. I like Abraham. I've said this before. I like him. I think he's a great character that brings some a little bit to the show. I said before, masculinity, a little bit of comedy. He says some really funny things. But make no mistake, he is a character. He's over the top, like I said before. And this is the first time that this show has ever brought someone into it where they don't come across as people you would meet in any day of the week. You know, these are not normal individuals or relatable in any case, right? There's very few people. You're very unlikely. I mean, you know, it's very unlikely that you're ever going to run into, you know, a Eugene in your life, right? Like, those people are rare, or even an Abraham. Like, Abraham's over the top too. And maybe that's okay. You know, maybe it's nice to see something new and maybe a little bit over the top to bring a little spark into the show. And certainly in terms of characters and being over the top, Eugene and Abraham won't really come close to what The Walking Dead is prepared to throw at us in the future seasons that I will eventually get to. But that they, But I can't help but dislike the entire idea of what Abraham, Eugene, and Rosita are doing. Okay, so when we meet them, we find out what their mission is. And I hate this. I can't stand it. I think it's poor writing. I think it's really stupid. It's laughable. Maybe it's supposed to be laughable, but the problem is, well, anyway, let me say this. Apparently, Eugene knows how all this started, the entire zombie apocalypse, and needs to get to Washington, D.C. to tell authorities. He has a solution. He knows how it started, and he knows how to fix it. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, does anyone realize how stupid that sounds? I mean, I understand if it's meant to sound stupid, and we were meant to realize that that's probably not true, which I'm sure we all did. Like, I was like, there's no way this guy knows. But we're not, you know, we're not supposed to think it's stupid or untrue. We're slightly supposed to believe that Eugene is just some like super smart guy with a mullet. You know, because Eugene tells Glenn and Maggie this, and even they believe him, right? If the main characters, if your A-list characters who have been with you the entire time, in this case, Glenn's been with us since season one, Maggie since season two, these are characters that we've all well-developed or had relationships with. They're the ones that are going to kind of dictate where our emotions go or how we feel about a certain something. If Glenn laughed at what Eugene said and was like, no, you don't, you're a fucking idiot. There's no way you know that. If he would have said that and not believed him, then we would have to know, okay, what Eugene is doing is obviously not true. Or at the very least, it's completely ridiculous because look, Glenn and Maggie aren't taking it seriously. Or any other main character, right? That we've, well, like Rick, for instance, the fact that Rick believes it, it's even more like, what? And so because these main characters are falling for it, you're forced to believe like, well, this might actually be serious because all the main characters aren't questioning this. And they're kind of going like, oh, we gotta go to Washington. And this guy knows how to fix things. And it's not like he actually tells them. He never really tells them. He just says it's classified. And I can't say, really? Now in season five, and I'll get to it, he does kind of open up in the very beginning a little bit more, but he doesn't ever give anybody any real information. I mean, did Glenn have like a moment of Alzheimer's? Like, did he forget that he was at the CDC in Atlanta and they literally said, like the doctor literally said they don't know where it came from and oh, and communications with everyone is gone? Meaning, hey, there's no officials anymore, not even in DC. Like, there's nobody left, man. Glenn doesn't mention that. I mean, I guess he forgot about the moment he was almost fried to death by the depressed CDC doctor. You know, did he just kind of dump that from his brain? The whole scenario is utter garbage. Because like, it's like, Abraham, you're risking your entire freaking life. Rosita, who's supposed to be, I would think, smarter than Abraham, is even just as dumb, blindly following his ass, taking him to DC as well. It's like, none of them know what the answer is from her because they know it doesn't matter. What do you mean it doesn't matter? It does matter. It matters completely. You're literally taking this guy to Washington, D.C. and risking everything. If I was going to do that, I would like to know what the fucking plan is. I would like to know, hey, man, what is your big secret? I don't care that it's classified. There's no such thing as classified anymore. We're in the zombie apocalypse. Everybody's dead. And if they're not dead, they're actively trying to kill each other. There's nobody that's going to put you in prison for saying classified information. I was part of the Human Genome Project. Okay, sure you were. I mean, I could understand if, you know, we've had characters, like for instance, I'll use the governor. Let's just pretend that guy came out. He's not the governor. He's just a dude. And he, you know, he comes out and goes, I was a doctor before all this. I know how it started, and I know how we could probably fix it, and I need to get to DC. That's more believable than a guy that can't even move his arms when he runs. Like, watch Eugene's character when he walks. He doesn't move his arms. He's a dope. Yeah, he knows some stuff because he reads, but good, big deal. Like, anyone could have seen through this. It's just, I look at him like, oh my gosh. Is this supposed to be comedic relief? Because it doesn't seem like it is, because like I said, all the characters are going along with it. Are we supposed to be the smarter ones right now going, haha, this is really dumb. I can't wait till Glenn and Maggie realize how stupid they are for believing this guy. But here we are. Everyone believing this crap, and the story just plugging forward. You know, it's just strange. And so as the group wanders around, they see signs for Terminus, and it's a safe haven for all. Eventually, everyone links back up there, only to find out it's not a very safe place. And they all get locked into a train car. Oh, no. What will happen? How will they escape? Who will die? How will Eugene ever get to Washington, D.C.? To save the planet. Wouldn't that be a bitch? If, like, you want to talk about, like, what if the whole show ended with Eugene, like, the whole series ended with Eugene saving the planet? How bad would that be? How would you go from season one and just the textbook masterclass in character development, character writing, story, plot, pace, everything about season one, so damn good. Season two, so damn good. How would you go from that to freaking Eugene, man? I got to get to Washington, D.C. Come on. You're killing me. Who wrote this? Anyway, guess we'll find out in season five. I know I sure am. All in all, though, I don't think season four was bad. I really enjoyed the first half the most. I definitely, if I had to say it, like I don't think there was anything wrong with the first half of that season. I really, really loved it. It was the second half the most I really disliked. I just thought it was very, felt like filler. It was like, hey, they've lost the prison and we've got all this stuff. We've got to figure out, we've got to get them from point A to point B, right? Point A is we've left the prison. It's gone. Point B now is get them to Terminus. All right. Well, how do we do that? And so, you know, sure, in hindsight, maybe it could have done better, but I just didn't like how it kept breaking away to different characters, and it just felt very all over the place. I mean, it really just felt like everyone blamed season two, saying, oh, it was just a season full of them trying to find a girl. There's no substance to it. It's like, no, there was a lot of substance there. This was literally just everyone wandering around in the woods and just talking. I mean, yes, there was the Marauder group that brought a little interesting. You got to see, we got to see Rick take a chunk out of a dude's jugular with his teeth. That was pretty epic. And by the way, you really want to be Rick in the apocalypse, for the record. Like, if you're ever in the apocalypse and you have to be a person, Rick is the guy you want to be. At least for now, this is the guy who has it all finally worked out. He can do what it takes without falling into some pit of despair and becoming evil. And he could step up. He can be the calm collective leader, and he could be the malevolent, the ruthless monster that he needs to be. However, I will say, as I started it off in the very beginning with my opening rant, the later half of this show may be foreshadowing of bad writing and characters to come. And, you know, 4 or 5 episodes into season 5, it's beginning to feel that way even more. And it's just extremely frustrating because season 1 and 2, even season 3, man, so good. And it feels like it's headed down the wrong path. But we'll see. I could be wrong. I could be misremembering. Season 5 may improve. Right now, so far, I'm like, what the heck? And so here we are. And on that note, folks, I hope you enjoyed part 4 of The Walking Dead. Of course, that was a very, you know, chopped up abbreviation of what happens in season 4. And the reason why that is because I could do a 3-4 hour show on season 4. There is so much that happens in season 4. There's no freaking way I could talk about all of it. Like I could literally do an episode on each episode of season 4. There's a lot going on. And that's probably one of the reasons why season 4 is still a very good, it still holds up and it's still good, because there is a lot going on. There's a lot of detail and storylines and different characters doing different things. And so you have to keep up, and it is interesting. That's why I don't completely hate the second half. But that was my kind of brief rundown of it. And I like it. It's fine. It's okay. It didn't finish strong, but it started great. And so on that note, we will be back probably next week for another special of The Walking Dead. It's very likely that I do another episode of The Rant this week. I just don't know yet. We've got to look at the schedule. But we will definitely be back next week, hopefully between Monday or Tuesday, if not Wednesday drop for part 5 of The Walking Dead, where I talk about season 5 and we go over that. Hopefully I don't go on to some tyrant or rage about some stupid thing a character said or some really bad writing, but we'll see. I'm not hopeful because this show is getting a bit on the corny side with some of the stuff it's doing, but I digress. So folks, thank you so much for being with me today. I hope you have a great evening. Thank you for listening. If you love the show, by the way, if you love this show, tell a friend. It helps me tremendously. I don't want money. I don't need donations. I don't need anything like that. I'm not on Patreon. I don't do any of that stuff. I do this show because I've always loved talk radio and I love podcasts and I've always wanted to do one. This is me doing it. If you're listening, you have no idea how much I appreciate that. It means the world to me. So if you liked listening and you think you know somebody else that might enjoy it, tell somebody. And at the very least, go on to Apple, iTunes, or Spotify. Leave me a review. You know, that helps so much because if you get enough people to review, then they'll take notice of the show and promote it. They'll put it on like their up and coming, their new shows or whatever. And so that would be fantastic. And so tell people, and you can also reach me. You could tell me how you felt about season 4 or season 3 for that matter. I don't know if I invited you to talk at me. Hit me up on Twitter. The Real DM King is on Twitter. You can also hit me up on Facebook at The Rant with David King and Instagram. You can also email me at davidking.therant@gmail.com where I will respond to your emails in kind. I love talking and hearing from you guys. Thank you so much and have a great evening. Bye now.